thank you ever so much for coming. This is John Desmond, and he's discussing sort of the beginnings of the NHS and how it was very much influenced by a group from the Tudega Medical Aid Society in Wales, and yeah, how it all went from there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Well, this evening I'm actually going to make three presentations, and the paper that's just been referred to, the paper entitled Lessons from the Tredegar Medical Aid Society, will be the middle of the presentations. So before I present that paper, I'll present a prequel, and then after I present the paper, I'll briefly introduce my work, the work that I'm currently undertaking in Wales about the health service. Now my guess is as follows, and it's only a guess, that the sequel about my current work about the health sector in Wales might be quite short. So for those of you who've heard enough of my voice by the time I finish the paper, don't have a nightmare that I'm going to just be going on all night, because I'm not likely to. Okay, the prequel. I suppose it's coincidental or appropriate, I should say, that a paper which is presented to a history group should have a history. And indeed, this paper does have a history. It has a history which comprises an unplanned series of events which began last year and which lasted 12 months. Two obituaries of the famous anarchist Colin Ward were published in a March issue of Freedom. One of them contained the following assertion: there can be no finer expression of mutuality than the NHS. Colin Ward thought otherwise. In his book Social Policy, he discussed the demise of the Tredegar Medical Aid Society and why it wasn't replicated in his essay entitled The Welfare Road We Failed to Take. In the conclusion of his essay, he asserted, "The appalling problem for you, as much as for me, is the question of how we get back on the mutual aid road." Very soon after the publication of the obituary of Colin Ward, the journal Anarchist Studies published its intention to produce a special issue comprising articles dedicated to his work and legacy. I was genuinely worried that a contribution to the issue might repeat the fundamental mistake which had been made in the obituary of him in Freedom. So I emailed the guest editor of the issue, expressing my hope that none of the contributions would repeat the mistake. The issue has just been published. It's on the web, Anarchist Studies. One of the articles is downloadable. 5 months later, in the September, I gave a talk about directional discourse in the radical history zone. During my talk, I mentioned my concept of counter-history, and I disclosed my intention to give a talk comprising a counter-history at the London Anarchist Book Fair. So it was that in the October, I presented a paper in a meeting at the book fair entitled Walter Conway and His Milieu, about the most famous secretary of the Tredegar Medical Aid Society. The meeting was hosted by Alan Woodward. Does anyone know Alan?
No.
Not familiar to you? Well, he knows you anyway. Unfortunately, he was unable to attend the book fair. He was taken ill very shortly beforehand. He himself runs a radical history group in North London. Very fortunately, I received an email from him last week, and he told me that he is now back to full health. I would not have produced my first counter-history without him. Consequently, I express my deep appreciation of his support. In January this year, I attended a national seminar in Cardiff about whether an Irons-Bevans founding principles for the NHS are still relevant. This was at the height of the anxiety about the reform of your NHS here in England. And quite frankly, if I were living in England, I'd be despairing about what the government is planning to do. I simply don't know how I'd be able to cope with it emotionally, quite frankly. So Wales was not oblivious to this planned reform of the NHS. So the establishment in Wales, the NHS establishment in Wales, organised a seminar which was held in the National Museum in Cardiff. The meeting was dominated by four professors, the chairperson, and all of the three keynote speakers. To my shock and disappointment, all of the professors missed a fundamental point. The point which they missed is that, as the ruling Labour Party in Wales ignores, Bevan could not have enabled the creation of the NHS without the precedent of the Tredegar Medical Aid Society. I thought that their presentations were superficial. I exclude one professor, Professor of General Medicine at the University of Glasgow, someone who had worked with the most famous GP, a socialist GP in Wales, who stood head and shoulders above all the others, quite frankly. But apart from him, I thought that all of them had missed the point. I attributed the fact that their presentations were superficial to the fact that they had missed the point that I identified, that Bevan couldn't have created the NHS without the precedent of the Tredegar Medical Aid Society. Within the last week, as a consequence of reflecting upon the seminar, a possibility has occurred to me about which I expect you know much more than I do. The possibility is that in some cases, a failure to acknowledge radical history cannot but result in the production of superficial ideas. I leave that with you as a challenge if it hasn't already occurred to you. I invoke in support of this possibility the transcript of an inaugural professorial lecture about the NHS, which I subsequently attended in Pontypridd in June, and which I also think was superficial. To return to the seminar, shortly afterwards, I emailed the guest editor of the special issue of Anarchist Studies about Colin Ward again, with feedback about it, in the hope that my feedback might be useful. So it was that in March, I received an email from one of the contributors. In her email, she asked me for my thoughts about how the example of Tredegar helps guide our critical insights into the current reforms of the NHS. Good challenge. I responded to her request by writing a paper, which I sent to her. My paper was based upon two concepts which I have subsequently been developing. They relate to two phenomena which I regard as being fundamentally important. The phenomena are the personality trait of feedback motivation and the collectivities of group and organisational enclaves. Don't worry, I'll define these terms very soon. So, my talk is based upon a revised version of a previous paper. I will complement it by outlining the work which I'm currently undertaking about the health sector in Wales. Let us now turn then to lessons from the Tredegar Medical Aid Society. Tredegar is located at the head of a valley above Newport, one of the many heads of the valleys. Its history dates back to the mid-15th century. Before Tredegar was built, it comprised small farms. They were displaced by a town following the exploitation of the joint availability locally of coal and iron. By the beginning of the 19th century, a succession of industrialists had begun to build furnaces and houses for the workers on the land which they owned, the whole of Tredegar. They formed a company, the Tredegar Iron Company, which eventually became the Tredegar Iron and Coal Company. The name Tredegar was appropriated by a local family, the Morgans, which had successive barons and viscounts. This is a history of Tredegar, and in the front is a photograph of Lord Tredegar. I'll come back to this history. With the rapid increase in the production of iron, reputedly Tredegar became a boom town, but the boom came at a human cost. Overcrowding and inadequate sanitation produced three cholera epidemics in 1832 to 1833, in 1849 and 1866. These epidemics required the creation of a special cemetery outside the town. Kevin Golight Cemetery is located at the top of the western side of the valley and is now a scheduled ancient monument of national importance. At least 200 people are buried there. In 1891, the death rate in the town was 40.74%. But two Whig historians of Tredegar were not alarmed. They observed, if we deduct, as the local medical officer of health does, the deaths of paupers in the workhouse, the average death rate of the period 1884 to 1899 would be appreciably lower. Thus, in 1891, it would be 38.05% instead of 40.74%. Powell and Powell. They proposed, may the motto of Tredegar be the best health and the longest life in the most efficiently governed town. It's in here. The same historians failed to mention the creation of the Tredegar Medical Aid Society in the previous year. It had two organisational statuses. Formally, it was a legal entity, a friendly society. And informally, it was a membership organisation. The society provided a health service for Tredegar. Each member paid threepence in the pound out of every pound earned by deductions from their weekly wages. Shopkeepers, school teachers and others, known as town subscribers, paid direct to the society an average of 18 shillings annually. In return, members became entitled to medical treatment from its four doctors and in its hospital. By the 1920s, the society had become so successful that 95% of the people of Tredegar belonged to it. Also, the NHS has two organisational statuses. Formally, it is a government agency, having been created in 1948, following the passing of the National Health Service Act 2 years previously. And informally, it is a public sector organisation. Of course, like Wales, it's divided into, we call them health boards, you call them trusts, I believe, yes? Yeah. Now in Wales, it is based upon 9 health boards. As a consequence of my research into and my reflections about the Tredegar Medical Aid Society, I think that I've learned many lessons from it about the Welsh health boards, which can be extrapolated to your NHS and beyond the whole of the public sector and indeed to the third sector, both in England and Wales. From these lessons, I will single out 3. The lessons relate to 3 concepts of mine about lateral responsibility, feedback motivation, and group and organisational enclaves. The lessons are hierarchical. So the first lesson is the basis or the foundation of the second lesson. And the second lesson is the basis or the foundation of the third lesson. So if you detect a certain continuity between the sections, that's the nature of, ideally, that is the nature of the continuity, like building blocks. Lateral accountability. If I go too fast, or if I become dreadfully technical, you must stop me, please. And if you have any questions, or I don't make myself clear, please, if I speak too fast, tell me to slow down. I define lateral accountability as accountability which accepts the existence of a quality. Lateral accountability is similar to my concept of lateral discourse, which is a type of directional discourse. I claim that the Tredegar Medical Aid Society was laterally accountable to its members. I support my claim with three sets of facts about its democratism. The first set of facts relates to the way in which the new secretary of the society was appointed in 1915. 50 people applied for the post. From them, a short list of 5 candidates was selected. Then a meeting was held, to which all the members were invited. I believe the meeting was held on a Saturday night, or Saturday evening anyway. Each of the candidates was required to make a presentation in front of the members to make the final decision. The successful candidate was Walter Conway, to whom I shall soon return. I've actually seen and handled the minute book in which the minutes of the meeting were recorded with the voting figures, and to the best of my knowledge, he won by a landslide. That's because he was already well known. He served in various capacities. The second set of facts relates to the AGMs of the society. According to a well-known Welsh radical, during the 1940s, they attracted 1,000 to 1,500 people. The likely nature of the AGMs can be guessed at from the following account. In any mass meeting of colliers or other workmen in South Wales, the usual practice was for anybody who had something to say to stand up and make their comment. Debate was open to anyone with anything to express on a particular matter, regardless of position or status. Furthermore, oratory at these public meetings involved an interactive relationship between speaker and audience that ensured that the opinions and feelings of society members were clearly expressed. Newspaper reports of the meetings show that speakers were constantly being interrupted with cries of approval or objection from those present, so that even usually inarticulate groups and individuals could make their feelings felt in a very direct way and play some part in determining actions and policies. I'll just give you a little respite for a second and tell you about the author of that article. He's a Labour historian and he's a lecturer at Aberystwyth University. And he makes a footnote which might be of interest to you, which Jen commendably suggested that I read out to you because she thought you might find it interesting. It's basically a continuation of what I've just said. Even usually inarticulate groups and individuals could make their feelings felt in a very direct way and play some part in determining actions and policies. And here's the footnote that he added. As an example of this tendency, Will Edwards recounted the story of an elderly miner who, at an otherwise inconsequential trade union meeting in the late 1900s in Aberdare, stood up to address the meeting about the, quote, abnormal conditions, end of quote, he was facing in his stall, and advocated that at the very least there should be a minimum wage. In this way, the elderly miner coined a new phrase in the miner's vocabulary, and the, quote, minimum wage, unquote, was destined to be not only a phrase, but also a phrase in the miners' struggle against the coal owners. True or not, Edwards wanted this story to symbolise the democratic nature of trade unionism at that time and the way in which ordinary people could make their voices heard and influence great events. This is an antithesis to what is called, and I don't know whether you're familiar with it, the great man theory of history, that history is determined by great men. That was a theory that I took a shot at in the talk that I gave at the Anarchist Book Fair. It was a counter history, and it was against the prevailing history about an Iron Bevan and the misrepresentation of Tredegar in the history of an Iron Bevan, in the book about an Iron Bevan.
Who is the historian you're quoting?
Well, I'm a bit embarrassed because actually the book is behind me and the author is Michael Foote, who was a self-confessed hero worshipper of an Iron Bevan, and I've read the book very closely.
But you said you were quoting for somebody who was a lecturer at Aberystwyth.
Indeed, yes. Oh, I beg your pardon. I'll tell you his name. His name is Stephen Thompson, and the passage which I quoted is in a book entitled "Medicine in Wales, 1800 to 2000: Public Service or Private Commodity." Medicine in Wales, Public Service or Private Commodity. Edited by Anne Bossey, published by the University of Wales Press, I beg your pardon, in 2003. And his chapter is entitled "A Proletarian Public Sphere, Working Class Provision of Medical Services and Care in South Wales." The third, I'll now continue with the third set of facts about the democratism of the Tredegar Medical Aid Society, and they relate to Walter Conway. I've got a photograph of him. You can just about see it. There is Walter Conway. Just about see him there. He was born in 1872. Sadly, his parents died when he was a young boy. Consequently, he was placed in the town's workhouse. Subsequently, he became a guardian on its board of guardians, in which capacity he served for more than 20 years, and he became chairman of the board. Walter Conway lived in a terraced house in Tredegar, number 1 Warlinson Terrace, and doubtless would have walked to the other side of the valley every day to the offices of the society, which were in the town centre. Number 10, the square. Number 10, the square, Tredegar, recently put on the market. We've been inside, and we've actually seen the safe in which the monies were stored. Huge safe, about 3 or 4 foot tall, on the first floor. Conway was a devout and active Presbyterian. According to a vignette about him by Kenneth Bryant, the son of a GP employed by the society, he was a deacon of his local chapel, where he and his family attended 3 services on Sundays. A photograph of the class of the chapel Sunday school, which is displayed in Tredegar Museum, the best kept secret of Tredegar, by the way, the photograph shows him in the centre, apparently as the teacher. A former local Labour MP described Walter Conway as the embodiment of truth and integrity and of all that was good in the life of Tredegar. The following short anecdote supports this tribute. Despite his great achievements in the public domain, it is perhaps his small acts of kindness and generosity which best sum up the character of this remarkable man. On one occasion, Walter came home one evening without his overcoat. Quite naturally, his wife was concerned and a little annoyed. It was a bitterly cold day, and she was anxious that he should not catch cold. Apparently, as she was to learn later, her husband had come across a poorly dressed old gentleman in the park. The old man had no coat, so Walter gave him his own. I don't know whether you picked up in that piece, as she was to learn later. You wouldn't tell her. So it seems. I now turn to the lateral accountability of the Welsh health boards to their patients. I claim that they aren't laterally accountable to them. Instead, in theory, they are circuitously accountable to them. Accountability in a health board is the same as in any bureaucracy. Excuse me. It is ascending. It ascends internally through its many bureaucratic levels and externally to the health minister and then to our community health councils. I understand that you no longer have community health councils. I believe that's the case. If you do, they must keep themselves very well hidden, I think. The health minister is accountable to our National Assembly and, theoretically, to the electorate. Circuitous accountability is not a poor substitute for lateral accountability. It is no substitute for it at all. A defender of the status quo might suggest to me in response or in criticism of what I've just said that there exist complaints procedures. So anyone who is dissatisfied can make a complaint. Well, I would have a lot to say about that in response as someone who has made a number of complaints against my local hospital and against my local authority and against the Welsh National Body as well. The problem with complaints procedures is that they immediately put the complainant I beg your pardon, into what's called a zero-sum situation. In other words, it's like a combat situation. You're instantly propelled into a situation in which either you win or you lose. There's no alternative. And unless you are very articulate and you document your evidence well, then you cannot enter complaints procedures with total confidence. You have to be capable of marshalling your facts. So that would be my response to the criticism that a defender of the status quo would make about complaints procedures. I would have other points to make about complaints procedures as well, but that's my main one. I support my claim that the Welsh health boards aren't laterally accountable to their patients with two facts about their democratism. First, their patients aren't given the opportunity to appoint their chief executives. Instead, they are appointed in their absence and in camera. And second, any influence that their patients might want to bring to bear upon them is effectively counterbalanced by lay representatives and organisations such as community health councils, local authorities, political parties and trade unions. I have a reference here which might take too long for me to ferret out. But we have a national daily newspaper called the Western Mail and it has a health correspondent. And she's not prone to extremism, to put it mildly. But on one occasion, she had cause to refer to the shadowy accountability of one of our health boards and the vested interests of the various groups in that context, which was quite excessive for her, but no surprise to me. The inference is that I infer from my claim that I've made my claim now that the Welsh health boards aren't laterally accountable to their patients. I infer from that claim that they are not feedback motivated. And this brings me to my next concept, the concept of feedback motivation, and which is the heading, if you like, for the second lesson that I want to introduce, that I've learned from the Tredegar Medical Aid Society. I define the personality trait of feedback motivation as the motivation to invite and respond to feedback. My concept of feedback motivation is the subject of a paper which is a work in progress. Because of the limitation of time, what follows is only a snapshot of it. I'll give you a brief informal illustration of feedback motivation. Some minutes ago, I was standing at the counter, and someone said, because someone had let someone else know that I read quite a lot, and therefore I'm quite familiar with a certain genre of literature, political literature of a certain kind. And it was, this person said to me, "We hope that you will make suggestions about what books this bookshop can stock." That is a nice example of feedback motivation, inviting feedback. That's the first component. Second component of feedback motivation is responding to feedback. Now, if I was to say, "Well, I think you should, you might like to consider this book. There's a book published by the Institute of Anarchist Studies, which AK Press have just started to publish, which I find extremely interesting by a very highly regarded American woman anarchist." Well, I would, but I am impressed by it. And then, if I was ignored, or the book never appeared on the shelf, or anything like that, then I would not call that a response to feedback. I call it a disregard of feedback. Okay? Now, I won't have time to go into responsiveness to feedback. I have a lot of experience of it about the Welsh health sector. Okay? So I'm going to limit myself to the motivation to invite feedback. And naturally, I was very gratified to experience that little vignette, that little living example of feedback motivation. Feedback motivation can be a trait of individuals, groups, and organizations. Fundamentally, and at the level of the individual, it is the motivation to improve oneself and implicates a positive attitude to feedback. Examples of people who are feedback motivated are sportsmen and sportswomen who continually monitor their performances in the hope of improving them. I don't know if you watch marathons as I do. When you see the runners crossing the line, you can see them consulting their wristwatches because they're desperate to know what their time was. Good example of feedback motivation. Naturally, they want to improve. Runners always want to run faster, obviously. Feedback motivation contrasts with complacency. It also contrasts with a negative attitude about feedback. An individual might have a negative attitude about feedback because they want to protect their image, and or because of their unconscious motivation to protect their ego. Feedback motivation exists contrastingly in the private sector and the public sector. Business managers and proprietors are feedback motivated. This is because their businesses are vulnerable to the discipline of the marketplace. By implication, their incomes are insecure. Consequently, if they are not feedback motivated, then they will jeopardize their incomes. They need to accept that they are fallible. Otherwise, they will risk going out of business and, in some cases, financial ruin. Generally, managers of Welsh health boards do not appear to be feedback motivated. This is because the health boards are not subjected to the direct discipline of the marketplace. By implication, their incomes are secure. Consequently, despite not being feedback motivated, they will not jeopardize their incomes. They do not need to accept that they are fallible, because they will not risk financial ruin if they are not. I have undertaken a survey of the Welsh health boards about the ways in which and the extent to which they invite feedback from their intended beneficiaries, members of the public. If the activity of inviting feedback is mastered, it can become a practice. The NHS in Wales has had 60 years to master the activity of inviting feedback. I have discovered from my research that unfortunately the health boards don't adequately invite feedback for members of the public. I suspect that if their managers acknowledge that inviting feedback is essential, which unfortunately is not guaranteed, then they regard the activity of inviting it as being similar to activities such as counselling, social skills training, and producing visual communications, which is that anyone can do it properly. Two blogs published this year are consistent with my discovery that Welsh health boards don't adequately invite feedback from members of the public. One blog was written by Kate Watkins, a one-time acting director of the Welsh NHS Confederation. This organisation, the Welsh NHS Confederation, is an organisation of Welsh health sector managers. In it, she futilely analysed the chimera of public engagement. Other chimeras are consultation, involvement, and participation. I'd like to make a point about these chimera, if I may. It's my strong suspicion that there are many managers in the Welsh NHS who know that they don't understand these concepts and phenomena. Okay? Public engagement, consultation, involvement, and participation. They just feel that they haven't got an adequate grasp of them. So what do? They go to consultants, management consultants. And this is wonderful news for management consultants. Yes, of course, we'll put you straight. We'll produce a report. And it will cost a lot of money. I have two such reports on my computer about engagement. One was produced in England and one was produced in Wales. One was produced for England, for your NHS, and the other one was produced for the Welsh NHS. And the one that was produced for the Welsh NHS was produced by a firm of consultants based in Manchester. The other blog was written by Professor Marcus Longley of the Welsh Institute for Health and Social Care. And this was last week, I think. In his blog, he offered, quote, four simple steps for 2012 to make performance on the patient experience absolutely transparent. The basis of them was to routinely survey a representative sample of patients. I should have put representative in quotes, because if you're familiar with sampling, then representativeness can be very, very elusive and expensive to achieve. The basis of his four simple steps was, quote, using intelligent questions, that's right, to routinely undertake a representative sample of patients, quote, using intelligent questions immediately after their episode of care is over. He concluded, quote, that would make the year 2012 something of a watershed for NHS Wales, end of quote. It's not untypical in the field of policy, administrative policy, for people to hope for magical solutions that will solve everything. And sometimes the solutions even come from other countries or from gurus. Either gurus who can speak, or gurus who write books. will influence the way people think. And they hope that that will solve everything. I don't happen to agree. I think it shows, it demonstrates a bankruptcy of ideas, foundational ideas, I mean. As I hope I have adequately identified, a manager of a Welsh Health Board who is not feedback motivated will essentially ignore members of the public. Of course, this is bad enough. But also they will risk something which is not easily identifiable, but which nevertheless is real and is dangerous. They will risk their health board becoming an enclave. I now turn to the last section and the last lesson, which is about group and organisational enclaves. And this is the subject of a paper. I define an enclave as a group of people which exists in isolation from its milieu, an organisation which exists in isolation from society, or a country which exists in isolation from other countries. A familiar example of a country which is an enclave that might be familiar to you is North Korea. A previous example of a country that was formerly an enclave is Tibet. A group or an organisational enclave, which is the type of enclave in which I'm particularly interested, is difficult to identify because it is fundamentally characterised by the absence of something. The absence is of an adequate invitation to submit feedback. This absence is the cause of enclaves. Perhaps I can just expand that for a second. When we identify something, we normally identify something, surely, by the presence of something. So someone who's arrogant, someone who's aggressive, we identify them from their aggressiveness, their arrogance. The difference about enclaves is that they're identifiable by the lack of something, something which isn't present. And this thing which isn't present is the practice to invite feedback. At the very beginning of my talk, of this talk, I hope I adequately invited you to give me feedback. To shut me up, don't understand what I'm saying, to ask me to be clearer, to slow down. My concept of a group or an organisational enclave is also the subject of the paper, which is a work in progress. Likewise, because of the limitation of time, what follows is only a snapshot of it. Group and organisational enclaves can be emotionally dangerous places because they are the natural habitats of people who crave power and who, in their pursuit or maintenance of it, emotionally harm other people. I've had experience of this. I guess perhaps some of you have worked in or belonged to enclaves in which people harm other people. People who crave power harm other people. I was motivated as a consequence of my experience in the NHS, having reflected upon the bullying which I experienced and witnessed, to write a paper about bullying, which I presented at a conference which was held in Cardiff a couple of years ago. This possibility is a sufficient reason why a health board should not become an enclave, the reason that they can become emotionally dangerous places. Another reason why a health board should not become an enclave is that doing so provides the impetus for the creation of trained incapacities, as part of which it will become incapable of fulfilling the ideal of a public service ethos as proposed by Diana Woodhouse. I bought this book by Colin Ward, second book by Colin Ward, in a charity shop, and I'm very pleased I did, because there is a chapter in it which sails very closely to this idea of, he talks about institutions, developing trained incapacities. Now, the ideal of a public service ethos was proposed by Diana Woodhouse. I don't know quite how to adequately describe Diana Woodhouse. She was a professor until recently, a few years ago, at Oxford Brooke University. And she was an expert in academic law. She was fascinated by the relationship between law and politics. And she subsequently became an expert in that. And in one of her books, she essentially claimed that the public sector has an ethos which has three sets of positive characteristics. First, it supports the idea of service as a vocation rather than just a job, and thus of officials being hard-working, conscientious, disciplined, and non-corruptible. Second, it demands an adherence to the law and due respect for the legally enforceable rights of individuals, and is also concerned with commitment to the public interest rather than narrower, sectional or private interests, and to the collective public nature of the administration. And third, it embodies values and principles arising from the culture of intervention and the welfare state. So that's the concept of a public service ethos as proposed by Diana Woodhouse. I have created a concept about the justifiability of psychological intervention. And I have written a paper about policy validity which is based upon it. I am an anarchist, and I largely accept Colin Ward's thesis about the breakdown of welfare, which is the subject of one of the chapters in this book. Because of these various facts, I regard the third set of characteristics as being vague and undesirable. Consequently, I also regard it as being unacceptable. But what about the other two sets of characteristics? They comprise five elements which I regard as acceptable. Service as a vocation rather than just a job. Officials who are hardworking, conscientious, disciplined, and non-corruptible. An adherence to the law and due respect for the legally enforceable rights of individuals. Commitment to the public interest rather than narrower, sectional or private interests. And commitment to the collective public nature of the administration. I can easily imagine that the Tredegar Medical Aid Society subscribed to these five elements. Think of Walter Conway. I have a photograph of the funeral cortege following the hearse of Walter Conway proceeding up the hill to Cefngoli, behind which is a long trail of local Tredegar people who wanted to be there to walk up the hill to the cemetery. Do the nine Welsh Health Boards subscribe to the five elements that I've highlighted and emphasised? I don't think so. All the elements are underpinned by feedback motivation. This relationship is crucial. If a health board is feedback motivated, then it is likely to endorse the elements. But if it is not feedback motivated, then it is extremely unlikely to endorse the elements. I've now reached my conclusions. This paper comprised three sections. In the first section, I contrasted the lateral responsibility of the Tredegar Medical Aid Society with that of the 9 health boards in Wales. In the second section, I examined the feedback motivation of the Welsh health boards. And in the third section, I discussed my concept of group and organisational enclaves and the ideal of the public service ethos as proposed by Woodhouse, Diana Woodhouse. In summary, I think that I have learned 3 lessons from the Tredegar Medical Aid Society about the Welsh health boards. First, they are not laterally accountable to their patients. Second, they are enclaves. And third, as enclaves, they cannot fulfil the ideal of the public service ethos as proposed by Woodhouse. So that concludes my talk. What I can briefly do, and this is without notes, is to describe to you the current work that I'm undertaking. There is an organisation which is based in England which is supposedly committed to improving patient information. At the time when I was working for an NHS trust, it didn't have a Welsh representative. And I found that difficult to live with, given my interest in the history of the NHS and Tredegar. It was actually before my interest in Tredegar. So I volunteered to do the job. But I made it clear that I am totally opposed to psychiatry. So I wouldn't cover anything to do with psychiatry, because I'm totally opposed to it. Well, they accepted me on those terms. I then began to develop a method for identifying news items about the NHS in Wales. And I began to collate website addresses of Welsh health sector organisations. And so it was, for a period of 4 years, every week, I would trawl these websites and I would then send the information as being links about news items which I thought were important. I think it was last year that someone from Cardiff, psychology graduate from Cardiff, it was announced that she had become the Welsh representative. I wasn't done, but she had become the Welsh representative. Nevertheless, I continued with the practice. And I sort of took an example of when, for my sins, I used to train in karate, for my sins. And one thing I learned, the only thing I learned, I think, from karate, because I'm useless at it, was it's based upon repetition. You repeat the moves endlessly, and that's the point. You repeat them endlessly to the point when they become automatic. So that's what I've done for the last 3 years. Every week, at the beginning of the week, I trawl the websites and I've been producing the links. And then it occurred to me, well, there might be scope here for an information service dedicated to improving the activities of providing health information and patient information in Wales. And so I began to write a paper about it. And because I'm committed to feedback motivation, I critique myself, and I began to develop the paper. And then, I think it was a fortnight ago, I had the first subscriber to my service. And it happened like this. And by the way, I hope I'll convince you that this service I'm providing is not merely, how can I put it, abstract or of no consequence at all, because I think it might have a consequence which feeds in to the paper that I've just given you. I call it my... I had what I call a Morrison's experience. I happened to be in the queue between two ladies in the queue, and they happened to be extremely large. Well, one of the managers told me in the house service when I worked in it that there is a time bomb ticking underneath the house service, both yours and ours. It's called Diabetes 2. And it results from overweight and lack of exercise. And these women were extremely large. Sometimes you can't help but notice what people buy. Is that the case? It happened to me this morning. Went into my local spa. Man, young daughter. Flagon of cider, flagon of pop, tub of ice cream, bag of sweets. Now, there was one gap in my knowledge base about the health sector in Wales, and I've had to be extremely careful about defining the limits, because the concepts of health information and patient information are very liquid. Those of you who know of the work of Zygmunt Bauman will recognise that word, liquid. Very difficult to pin down. Nevertheless, I found myself contacting an organisation which is concerned with food cooperatives. And, as we know, we're in the middle of an economic crisis. And my heart goes out to people who simply don't have the money to buy healthy, nutritious food, particularly if they're living on a council housing estate. When the only shop is a spa, which was tin food and expensive food. They haven't got the money to go looking for the bargains. It's very difficult. I have a background, by the way, in anti-poverty work as well. And so I contacted this individual and I came clean. I said, listen, I said, don't touch psychiatry. Don't have anything to do with it. But she said, well, can I receive your list? And I said, well, yes. And that's what happened a fortnight ago. Now I'll put myself on the spot and invite you to criticise me if you're not convinced by what I'm about to say. There are researchers in Wales undertaking research into health. And there's a clinical psychologist in South West Wales, and she's developing a method of dealing with obesity, which she calls a holistic method, right? It's not merely sending messages to eat nutritious food and be a good boy or be a good girl. It's to take a holistic approach to examine the person's life, to see what choices they're making, the influences to which they're subjected. Sounds very good. I sent an email to her. I had to route it via the communications officer of the health board. Not direct. I had to go through it. And no response. No reply. Not unusual. Do you remember I mentioned earlier about responsiveness to feedback? I've got a list of it. I could make you cry, but I won't. Second opportunity occurred a couple of weeks ago. As a computer scientist undertaking research in Aberystwyth University. And his research is based upon the way people's faces change as a consequence of eating unhealthy food. And he's developed a method of taking an original face, the person's original face, and producing various versions of that individual's face, which could be predicted to become fulfilled as a consequence of eating unhealthy food. And his hope is that when people are shown these pictures, they will act as a sufficient deterrent to deter them from eating unhealthy food. Well, I I emailed him directly. I had his email address. No reply. No reply. Now, one needs to be very, very careful. I need to be extremely careful about what I'm about to say, because I once belonged to a think tank in Wales that was extremely pretentious, and it was also an enclave, and I left it in disgust. But it was called the Welsh something. It was pathetic. It was just limited to a chap and his mother and me, basically, and basically a handful of people. We had a committee meeting one night, and the only people present were the officers. I couldn't help but notice. So, conceivably, I could produce something for Wales. But there is a risk. As is well known in anarchism anyway, that centralisation can lead to centralisation of power and the corruption that can result from the centralisation of power. So I'd like to immediately reassure you that I have no desire whatsoever to be a king of a particular castle, but my hope would be that there could exist in Wales networks of the dissemination of information about innovations in the provision of health information and patient information that could benefit people. For this reason, the assumption is made, as I mentioned in the paper, that anyone can do it. That anyone can do it. Only very recently, a patient information leaflet was published on the web by my local health board, which refers to readability and fails to mention legibility. It mentions readability, but it fails to mention legibility. Legibility, readability, usability, they are the three foundations of the psychology of visual communication. And yet, they fail to mention legibility. And there are two ironies here. Firstly, it has a reduced legibility. What is the point of distributing literature if people cannot physically read it or have difficulty in reading it? Such as transcripts of inaugural professorial lectures with a type font of that size. Now, I mentioned one irony. Legibility wasn't mentioned. The other irony is that the same health board has a patient information team or production unit or patient information unit, and it produces excellent material. So you have a situation in a health board, my health board as it happens, whereby the one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing. Coming back to the two researchers, in both cases, I told them that I had created a concept about the justifiability of psychological intervention. There is a very well-known phrase: the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Do you know that the physician or the neurosurgeons who invented lobotomy received the Nobel Prize? Thousands of lobotomies were undertaken. I'm not about to give a talk about psychiatry, okay? So I'm not about to go off on a tangent. Thousands of operations were conducted. It's now no longer undertaken, to the best of my knowledge. So that is a trap. And this is one of the traps that I address in this paper. And I'm coming to the conclusion now, because I hope I've been able to convince you that there is at the very least the possibility of a counterpoint, a counterbalance to the non-responsiveness of public officials for whom it is very easy and safe not to respond to communications or feedback from members of the public. So I think I'll conclude just by leaving you that thought, and also the invitation to critique it. Thank you.
His wife for coming all the way down to Newport. It was lovely and I found it really interesting. So I don't know about the rest of you, but thank you.
I always dislike it when people end up asking really, really long questions, but I've got an awful lot of points, so I'll try and keep them brief. But I was wondering, what was the population of Tregaga, and sort of on top of that, sort of scalability? And I was sort of wondering if there was some kind of democratic version of a management consultancy company. But then I suppose, would that not be, could that be some form of think tank? I've never heard of a democratic and particularly useful think tank. I don't know if that's just sort of my ignorance of things. So I suppose, and also I was thought of a couple of things in relation to enclaves. There's a chap called John Ronson who's recently done a book called The Psychopath Test, and noticing how it seems to be the case, you can obviously question the validity of a psychopath test in and of itself, but it seems to be the case that a lot of heads of corporations who I suppose are in these enclaves are very much, they seem to tick all the right boxes in these psychopath tests. I mean, obviously a psychopath test is a very flawed and strange thing, but I wonder if that sort of played in with the enclaves element. I wonder if you had any ideas on how you could set up a democratic way of sort of creating a large scale organisation such as the NHS without getting those enclaves. I suppose I wonder if you have any sort of ideas for the future.
I do indeed. I've given this matter an enormous amount of thought, actually. I take as my starting point probably the anarchist collectives of Spain, which were very successful, but which tragically had their enemies, of course, both the fascists and the communists. Now, as you will have guessed by now, I'm totally committed to anarchism. But the issue is, you know, what can be done? That's the famous historical issue, right? Here now. It's all very well reading the history of anarchism in Spain, which I have done. But what about the present? And I hope I'm going to answer your question, and if I don't, you must tell me. We live in such dire times. Parliamentary democracy has received such an expensive scandal. The media scandal. This just happened. Murdoch Empire. News International. The Leveson Inquiry. I don't know whether you've been able to hear parts of it. It's unbelievable. So you have Parliament, the press, and last but not least, the banking sector, which seems to be untouchable. If ever there was a scope for an alternative to that, it must exist now. And how is that scope to be fulfilled? Well, in my opinion, it's fulfilled by people becoming attracted to an alternative that has merit, that they perceive as having merit, right? And in my opinion, if we're talking about organisations, which I think we are fundamentally, that is to say, working collectively, the very starting point must be to endorse a commitment to feedback motivation, to provide people systematically, continuously, with the opportunity to give feedback. Now, I attended an event some years ago about health, and I think it was in the context of psychiatry, and it was quite an experience. There were the usual keynote speakers, but unsuspected to the organisers and to myself, there were a considerable amount of people present who were extremely angry. And you know what? They wanted to speak. And also, they insisted on speaking. And it was very dynamic. It was quite... I've never experienced anything like that. I suspect that there is a huge latent desire out there of people wanting to be able to speak, to be heard, to be listened to. And I think any organisation which invites feedback properly and continuously will attract people, because they will have the confidence in that organisation that they will be listened to.
I suppose there's a big arrow between science and feedback on my notes. And I think that sort of, to me, sums up the... I'd imagine you could get, as you described in the place that begins with T, that I will not embarrass myself, I'm trying to say again.
Tredegar.
That everybody could meet in a hall and shout at somebody. And I don't know how that would work on... I suppose you'd need to have... You'd need to have obviously sort of smaller points of contact for centralisation, I suppose, rather than large ones. You couldn't have something. I don't imagine how you could even have a system of feedback on for a city the size of Bristol.
Let me give you an example. Let's suppose you had a website. On that website, one could invite feedback from the visitors to the website. Right? Now, you could do that more or less properly. You could do it minimally, as many organisations in the Welsh health sector do, by just putting a tiny word, feedback. No. I've got excellent examples of organisations inviting feedback on their website. It sends out a wonderful message. We're interested in what you think.
But are they really?
Yeah.
Mm. And the other thing is this, and I go into a lot of detail about this, actually. It's one of my favourites. Just reflect upon the retail sector. I can quote lots of examples. Currys, PC World, Comet. There are cards made available for people to submit their feedback. I've got a whole list of them here. I've got pages of it. BT, Little Chef, they give you a postcard. And you're invited to rate the attitude of the person serving you. Of course they're committed to feedback, because their customer depends upon it. They're very, very good at it. Tesco's. They do it in lots of different ways. They put little slips of paper in the aisles, on the till receipts. I've probably got a till receipt, you know, in which...
I think they're promoting the illusion of feedback far
well, not
more
really.
Than...
Think about... Think it, perhaps... just think about this. They could employ very expensive management consultants to give them a report. And they produce it. Yeah, we'll produce a report. They're getting that feedback from the customers for nothing. Now, some of it might be rubbish. Some of it might be biased, or, you know, but some of it just might be useful. I can develop this example. I belong to an organization. I go to an organization. I won't disclose the nature of it, okay? It's perfectly legal and everything. I happen to, as you might have guessed, have lots of ideas about how to invite feedback. For example, in a journal. Yeah? This is a Welsh journal called Planet. Okay? It's not a problem to put an invitation for feedback in. We would welcome your comments, any criticisms, suggestions for articles, anything. Yeah? Goes in once, doesn't require any work, and it's a win-win situation. Because if some of the feedback isn't practicable, then you can't apply it. You can't put it into practice. But if it is,
put on a winner. The thing about postcards and the internet is you're alone in doing that. You submit it alone as a person, whereas in a meeting, there's a sort of an automatic democracy, like you were saying, how in the psychiatry meeting, they weren't going to be silenced. You know, it was the case that those people were doing
it. If we had had the time, and we haven't had the time, and if you think to yourself, well, why hasn't he developed this more? I've devised an evaluation form, and had we had the time. And it's been quite short notice. I didn't receive much notice for this, and everyone's busy. I know it's a phenomenal achievement that you've produced it. Had we had the time, I could have introduced you to a form which I could have distributed to all of you, which would have given all of you the maximum opportunity to give you feedback about this talk. And ideally, I would have wanted to. But the only reason I wasn't able to was because of lack of time.
Can I just ask about the Tradiga Medical Aid Society?
Yes.
Was it directly influenced by anarchist ideas? I mean, that was the time of the Miners Next Step, Big Bill Haywood from the Industrial Workers of the World was in South Wales at that time.
Yes.
I mean, the date of the creation was just after those events, wasn't it?
I'm not sure about those dates, but this is a subject which has greatly interested me, because I've read An Iron Bevan by Michael Foote. I've been interested in this myself. Walter Conway was a member of the Independent Labour Party, right? Now, I believe socialist ideas came into the valleys from the Labour College in London, and that's an institution that Bevan attended, and where he was introduced to Marxism. But he wasn't very impressed with Marxism, I think that's what he said. If and only if this is to be believed, and I've given you a little snapshot of some of it's extremely economical with the truth. I mean, the description about the cholera. I mean, there was overcrowded, a huge overcrowded, typical, you can imagine. I need to be able to have documentary evidence for that. But right at the very end, there's a reference made to the drunkenness, the widespread drunkenness in Tredegar. And this is how it was. By local legend, this is a local, and I'm coming onto the point. According to local legend, the wives of the men employed by the Tredegar Iron and Coal Company on Friday nights used to assemble outside the gates of the company to waylay their husbands before they spent the housekeeping money in the pubs. There were lots and
maybe
lots.
Maybe not all that funny
actually.
There were lots of pubs in Tredegar. The men worked hard, but they also drank hard. Now, there was a collection of men in Tredegar who were religious. Walter Conway was a Presbyterian, a devout Presbyterian. And they were motivated by their religious commitment. We have a friend. She'd be in her 80s now, Sylvia? 70s. Our friend's father was a mayor of Tredegar, chairman of the district council. Like Walter Conway, he had a road named after him. There is a Walter Conway Avenue, and there's a road named after Stockton Terrace. Sylvia, who knew Anaya Bevan and his wife, and who expressed to me her regret that Walter Conway hadn't received the credit to which he was due, said that a lot of people were motivated by their religious commitment, their religious ideals. But it's perfectly obvious that Conway was also a socialist, and this wasn't unusual for people to be both Christian and socialist, as indeed I am also a Christian and an anarchist, and I have no difficulty in that whatsoever. Now, as for anarchism entering South Wales, the biggest location of anarchism in South Wales, I believe, was in Neath. And coincidentally, Neath was an enclave. And there's a slogan in Neath: Neath against the world. And I have a friend who has written a biography, a very famous anarchist called Sam, I've got to get the pronunciation right, Sam Mainwaring, who married a woman called Emma Goldman.
I have to correct you on that, I'm afraid.
Is it?
He married, it was Jim Colton who married Emma Goldman.
Was it? I beg your pardon. Yeah. But, yes, that's right. And they lived in Ammanford, which is further west of Neath. But certainly Neath had a tradition of extreme left-wing politics. Neath was founded by the transportation of criminals from England. And so they had a natural tendency to be radical and non-conformist. And I believe it was the case that anarchism did have a hold in that part of Wales, southwest Wales. Leo Apsey, in his book entitled Private Member, refers to his experience of going to a trade union meeting, I think it was in Cardiff, at the back of which were a group of anarchists. But they've never been very strong in South Wales. There have been pockets of it. And Ammanford, you'd argue, is the most unlikely place for anarchists to be in South Wales, because it's quite isolated. It's West Wales. But it's a story which has greatly interested me, the transmission of the ideals, the socialist ideals that were emerging around that time, the beginning of the century, and how they were put into practice. And they did obviously form a huge component of political life in South Wales. Unfortunately, some people were ambitious, and Anaya Bevan was one of them. And as a local resident said to me, he left Tredegar as soon as he could. Walter Conway remained in Tredegar all his adult life. He used to make trips to Whitehall because he became an expert in law, to such an extent that he was able to debate law with Whitehall officials on equal terms. He was a brilliant man, self-taught.
When did he die and when was he born?
1933. And I've tried to locate descendants, not with too much success at the moment. But I think you alluded earlier to accountability, and I think it might help you to know that Jen, who spent much of her childhood in Chediga, because her mother's family came from there, said that, in her experience, everyone knew everyone. And the Welsh are typically curious. They're desperate to know about you. So it would have been a case that everybody knew everyone. And the case, the reason I included that vignette about Walter Conway going to chapel three times every Sunday was not to promote Christianity, it was just to give you the idea that here was a public man who was publicly available. So if anyone had a problem, they would know where he lived. You know, he was approachable. That was how it. That's how it was. But another answer to your question, it relates to geography. Because at the top of the valley, it's hemmed in on three sides. It can't grow any bigger. So there is a small is beautiful, Shoemaker. Is it Shoemaker? Small is beautiful. Beyond a certain size, then accountability becomes extremely difficult. The first NHS trust that I worked for was called Bromoganog. Sorry about this. Bromoganog. Okay? That covered Swansea and Neath. Then that was replaced by Swansea NHS Trust, which was confined to Swansea. And that was replaced by, wait for it, Abertawe Bromoganog University Health Board. Now, when the health boards were, or the trusts were still, were originally floated, I seem to remember, but unfortunately not being able to locate it, the declaration by Welsh politicians that the creation of the trusts would give people a greater sense of ownership over their local health service. They'd know that it was theirs. Why? Because the name would give it away. The name would tell them. Unfortunately, when I worked for Bromoganog NHS Trust, I didn't know. I didn't know the domain. And I put the question to a colleague at the time, if you were to walk out into the street and take the first 100 people, you wouldn't need to, of course, and to ask them a simple question, who runs your health service locally? They simply wouldn't know. And then, to add insult to that, within the space of a very short period of time, Bromoganog, Swansea, Abertawe, Bromoganog. It was back to square one, actually. They've gone a complete circle. So any sense of ownership that people simply doesn't happen. So there's an issue there about scale.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about the influence, the anarchistic and socialistic influences coming from England, I think you said. Didn't Nicholas Aglaice say that T. Nicholas... T.E. Nicholas, who was a communist poet, preacher, dentist, he wrote the Welsh words to the Internationale. And I believe it was him that said he got most of his political ideas from the cooperative tradition in the Welsh countryside, that old tradition of country people, you know, farmers cooperating with each other.
Well, there is.
I think it's deeply in the culture. And also, I'm wondering how much influence the Welsh Annibynwyr, the congregational chapels, had, that democratic tradition, and also the tradition of speaking back to the preacher, which I believe was quite strong in that chapel tradition. It wasn't just that you kept quiet all the time, you know, and listened to the preacher or the speaker, but you would say hallelujah, or you would, I don't know what exactly, I've heard that there was a lot of interaction in those chapels.
Well, there is, commendably, in Wales, some people have seen the light, actually, that By cooperating, you stand a better chance of survival than by competing. It's true. And it's common sense to us, but not to other people.
And to rediscover something that, you know, our great-grandparents, or some people's great-grandparents, had done all their, you know, for generations.
Well, you see, this is the point. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just wondering if I am allowed to make a comment.
Yes, please.
In response. Come clean, because I come from a family of Welsh nonconformists, but I'm actually an Anglican priest myself. But yes, the chapel tradition in the valleys was very, very strong. It was deeply communal as well. A lot of it stemmed from the early years of the 20th century and the Welsh evangelical revival, although areas like Tredegar by then were not primarily Welsh-speaking. Nonetheless, there were English preachers as well who were quite significant. And from their point of view, they saw a lot of the deprivation, the poverty and everything else that's being suffered as being completely contrary to what they were rediscovering about what they believed to be essential gospel message about serving the poor and helping other people. And so there was a lot which was infused by that kind of religious faith, going back to the words of scripture, not the words as the established church had kind of filtered them out over the centuries to them. So the chapels were very vibrant places for social activities. The established church in those days, less so. There was a link. People didn't see a difference between what they did on Sundays and what they did on weekdays. They were being themselves and true to their beliefs and ideals in what they did every day of the week. And that was how a lot of the social improvements that were brought about by organisations like Tredegar Medical Aid, under the guidance of people like Walter Conway. But Walter Conway, I think, would have been the first to say that the work he did was supported by the work of an awful lot of other people as well. And they didn't seek to promote themselves. What they sought to do was to make living conditions better for other people. I don't know if that helps.
Yes, I'm about to say something which greatly shocked me, because Jen recently came across an obituary of her great-grandfather, and it was very similar to the obituary of Walter Conway, which is extremely moving, because they left him, you know, he worked for Tredegar, basically, and it was a bit of a shock to me to discover that the obituaries of these two people, Walter Conway and Jen's great-grandfather, were very, very similar, qualitatively speaking. Walter Conway was undoubtedly a brilliant man, self-taught, from the workhouse. He was a workhouse boy, became chairman of the Guardians. It seems that Jen's great-grandfather was also an extremely talented man. I think what can happen in certain types of social arrangements is that people who have talent, it can be enabled to flourish. And other types of social arrangement, that talent is not allowed to flourish.
Such as putting chairs in rows.
Yes.
As opposed to putting chairs in a circle.
When I was in the NHS, I had an idea for saving money. And a competition was organised, a Welsh competition was organised for innovation. And I submitted an idea to this competition. In fact, I submitted two ideas. Now, interestingly, I didn't have to tell my manager, because there was no proscription about having to go through your manager. Okay, I'll come back to this in a second. So it was that I made two submissions, and it was run by a firm of intellectual copyrights experts in England, and they set up an office in Wales. And so it was that I was interviewed by one of their employees, a top rate management consultant. And so he asked me to explain my two submissions, which I did. And my manager knew nothing about this, by the way, nothing at all. And it was, the meeting was held on the floor above his office. And he said, oh, he said, we've had so many submissions. He said, we've had to create an extra prize. And I said to him innocently, I said, oh, that's great, isn't it? That's good news. So it was that Jen and I turned up at the award ceremony. And this is not about me. This is about enabling talent to become fulfilled and that certain types of social arrangements that can enable that to happen. So it was that Jen and I turned up at the competition. And the health minister was there, and there were these plaques for the prizes, you see. But a sharp-eyed person would have noticed that there was one plaque in addition to the plaques that would have were planned to be given, to be awarded, you see. So they awarded all the prizes. And then the chairman announced, he said, we had a submission about a recycling scheme. Well, that was one of my submissions. And I thought to myself, well, there can't be many people in Wales submitting. So I put my papers on the ground. And he said, we weren't able to ignore it. He said, we kept coming back to it again and again. This scheme, this recycling scheme, I'd created this recycling scheme to save money, to save the engine. So he said, I decided to break the deadlock, he said, by saying, listen, he said, I'm the chairman. I'm going to decide to make a special award to represent the spirit of the NHS. Now, for which I received an award. Now, subsequently, the NHS have taken on innovation. Interestingly, all ideas for innovations have to be, what do they call it, channeled through their managers. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to try and imagine how many ideas would be filtered out.
Or stolen.
Or stolen. Or filtered out. Because certain, I don't want to sound unkind, I mustn't sound unkind, because certain managers don't want to be upstaged. And there is no better way of upstaging your manager by receiving a national award, which wasn't his idea. So I think that can happen. That can happen. People can derive self-confidence. And that's what they did. They ran a health service. And it was that idea that Bevan took. However, when he became Minister for Health, people naturally assumed when he said, I am going to triggerize you, that he would be advocating the creation of lots of medical aid societies. But it didn't happen. And what did he do? He tried to... he had two voices. Yeah, one for his constituents and one for the others. And he said, you've become so successful, he said, you've done yourselves out of a job. Back to Colin Ward. But there was another point, this has passed my attention, but... yes, there are cooperatives in Wales, and, but the point was I wanted to make, is this a final one, is that if we got, if we were able to get back to the models that of, you know, people at the beginning of the 20th century operated quite naturally, involving a free exchange of ideas, then we wouldn't have to tie ourselves up in knots by reflecting about participation, engagement, involvement. Waste of time, complete waste of time. They can't solve them. Can't solve them. So what I pin my hopes on is being seen to be different. By being feedback motivated, by inviting feedback, and in that way demonstrating that you're doing things differently. You're not ignoring people. You're allowing them the opportunity to speak and saying to them, your ideas are important. Even the ones that are critical of what I am doing are still important. I'm going to speak too long if I'm not careful. Like, you know, I'll give you a break. Is that sufficient?
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming down, John. It's been really nice to hear everything. Thank you
very much. Here.
There's some coffee in the coffee machine.